Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and feminist scholar Jamie Warburton. Warburton received an MFA in writing from Sarah Lawrence College. She is currently visiting assistant professor in the writing department at Ithaca College. Her work has been published in many journals and magazines, including Broom Review and Dark Sky Magazine. Her first collection of poems entitled Note That They Cannot Live Happily was published by Split Oak Press in 2009. And welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thank you.
Now, you describe yourself as a product of a nun-driven education. Tell us how this has affected and influenced you.
Well, I grew up surrounded by the Sisters of Mercy in Erie, Pennsylvania. I started an education with them at the preschool level, with Mercy Center for the Arts.
Wow.
I'm still in contact with my preschool science teacher, Sister Margie. I continued to study with nuns in flute and voice. I attended Mercyhurst Prep, a high school founded by the Sisters of Mercy. I used to hang out and eat dinner at the Mother House.
Wow.
We were good friends.
Uh-huh. So does this mean that you have a religious bent as well?
Well, I was raised Catholic. And many people say that, don't they?
They
I was
do.
Raised Catholic.
Yes, yes. I could say that as well.
Yes. And so much of the real sensory relationship to that kind of religion has stayed with me, and a deep love for the ritual, mm-hmm. and the kind of smells and sounds and feelings of Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
I describe myself as perturbed religiously. I definitely think about religion and faith and spirituality a lot.
Uh-huh. Well, tell us when you discovered writing amid all this incense and candles.
Well, I was a reader first, as I think any writer is or should be. I loved to read from the time I was 3 on up, and some of my most enjoyable childhood memories are from the summer. My father would set up this little maroon pup tent in our backyard, and I would go to the library and get one of those stacks of books you have to balance with your chin. It's so high, and kind of throw them into the tent and just stay there in the sun, in the shade of our apple tree, and I would just read. And writing was a natural outgrowth of that real love for language and narrative and figuring out that peculiar sensation of what the exact word is for what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so did you start out writing poetry?
Yes, actually.
Uh-huh.
Terrible poems.
It seems like everybody starts out writing terrible poems.
And
no
some of us
what.
End out writing terrible poems, too. But yes, I did write poetry. I was never really a story writer, although, of course, story is the most important element to any kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to write the great American novel, and God willing, I never will.
Well, tell us about your first collection. I love this title, Note That They Cannot Live Happily.
Mm.
Tell us about the title and the ensuing
book. Well, I'm often influenced by fairy tales. And I loved to read fairy tales. I still do. And one of my favorite things to do is to retell a fairy tale or to get into the minds of the characters and twist it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that title for me is of course, a play on A Happily Ever After.
Mm-hmm.
The tone of it, too, has something to do with the almost academic bent that I think I still sometimes bring to poetry. I remember running into a novelist whom I hadn't seen in years. He said, oh, what are you doing? I said, poetry. He said, you? Miss Analytical? I said, well, yeah, it's always been both.
Yeah.
So that combination is inherent in the title for me.
Uh-huh. And so does this collection have a theme? Tell us about the collection. It's very interesting, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It is kind of about fairy tales. Some of the poems in there are direct sort of reworkings of the fairy tale. Some of the speakers, the characters, might be recognizable as witches.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of witchery in there. Kind of taking a look at the same sort of family relationships that come out of fairy tales. I mean, that's why we tell them. It's about love and death and food and your mother and what happens when your father isn't home.
Mm-hmm.
And those stories are all in these poems.
And they're also haunting,
mm-hmm.
fairy tales,
mm-hmm.
to me at
Absolutely.
Least. Most of them are.
Yeah. They're dark.
They are. They scare kids. I've always thought that they were more scary than entertaining in some ways, especially for kids' imagination.
And a thrilling fright.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, I want to have you read a poem from Note That They Cannot Live Happily, and I'd like you to read the title poem and tell us a little bit about it before you read it.
Certainly. Now, this poem, as many poems do, has an epigraph, and it is from a fairy tale. It's from The Goose Girl. This version of it is as told by the Brothers Grimm. Mm-hmm. And The Goose Girl is a fairy tale that follows a princess and her haughty lady's maid. As they travel, they leave the princess's home, and they leave her mother, and she's on her way to become a bride. But the lady-in-waiting thwarts her along the road and presents herself as a false bride, and the princess ends up needing to work as a goose girl. But lucky for her, she has this talking horse named Falada. And although the lady-in-waiting tries to get him to shut up by killing him and cutting off his head, the head still manages to speak. And there are three separate voices in this poem. The first section is told by the princess's mother, and the second is the princess, and then the third, and I would say most important, is the horse. So this is Note That They Cannot Live Happily. When the hour for departure drew near, the old mother went to her bedroom, and taking a small knife, she cut her fingers till they bled. Then she held a white rag under them, and letting three drops of blood fall into it, she gave it to her daughter, and said, "Dear child, take great care of this rag. It may be of use to you on your journey." From The Goose Girl. 1. Leave me for a husband, daughter, my flesh doll. I picture you waiting by a new window. But take me with you, against your breast, hidden. You'll still see me, leaning down to drink. I am duck bones boiled in milk, the scent of roast meat on the wind, the sound of knives through celery. 2. Dear mother, today your blood floated down the river. A pity, the handkerchief was soft. Still en route to castle, weather fine and warm. 3. Straight ahead. Philosophy texts in my saddlebags may disagree, but I say it's the best way. With blinders, to my left could be anything. Apple trees, sorcerers, home. Sun up, walk. Sun high, walk. Sun down, kneel down. Nothing changes, but everything might. I could find myself on a bluff. I could kick loose stones. I could lose this load. But carrying's just carrying. We stop. I listen. We start. Someone runs off behind me. Moccasins. Scuffing. A bride gone? Doesn't matter. Not to me. Who could tell from shifting weight? Princess? Lady's maid?
Wow, that's great.
Thank you.
And you know the thing about fairy tales? It said in your biography that you're interested in fairy tales and gender. And so often women are victims in fairy tales. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Fairy tales have emerged as such a feminine and such a little girl kind of thing. And really, there have been so many fairy tales that focus on men and on little boys and on heroes. And we've lost them. The fairy tales that have become Disneyfied and really embroidered into our popular culture tend to be so female-centered and so princess-centered, but that's not really what fairy tales are all about.
Either stepmothers or princesses, you know, women as victim, either way.
Yeah, there's a lot more guts to the real fairy tales than that. But when it comes to victimhood, we often think of the heroines of fairy tales as being exemplars of passivity. The more passive she is, the more she's rewarded. And the more active she is, the more likely she is to be evil. And I like to tell the story when I would watch Sleeping Beauty as a child, I identified with the witch all the way. And I was just ooh, it felt so good in the living room in front of the TV. And then, but when it became clear that she was about to lose, I would pause the tape, run into the kitchen, pull off a sheet of tinfoil, fold myself a little silver tiara, put it on my head, run back in the living room, and start identifying with the princess for the last 5 minutes because I didn't want to be on the losing team.
Wow.
And I think some of what I do with fairy tales is try to knit those desires. I want to win, but I don't want to be passive.
Yeah.
And I don't think we want that for our daughters.
Yeah,
either.
I think that's been the dilemma of feminism from day one.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I worked on Neil Gaiman's Coraline on some issues with how active or passive Coraline is as a heroine in the varieties of ways of telling that story in the original novel, the graphic novel adaptation, the film adaptation. Mm-hmm. And that was a really fascinating look at what happens in these modern fairy tales. Or we assume that girls in our new fairy tales are going to just kick butt.
Exactly.
You know, like Cameron Diaz. They never have any muscle tone, but they're going to kick butt anyway. but is that enough? Is that true active behavior?
Yeah. Because we have to encourage girls to have inner strength as well, not just muscles.
Absolutely.
Because that would be just imitating men, and it's cartoonish.
Yes, yes.
Now, you wrote a paper called Compulsory Heterosexuality, mm-hmm. Compulsory Mediocrity, mm-hmm. The Queerness of the Gifted Girl.
Yeah.
Fascinating title.
Oh, thank you.
What were you talking about in that?
Well, that, again, is drawn from children's literature.
Mm-hmm.
And there tends to be the idea that if a girl is academically gifted, there's something wrong with her. And many girls will hide their academic talents or attempt to grow out of them, whether or not they really do grow mm-hmm. out of them. There's some sort of relationship between the token smart girl and what may later emerge as a token queer girl in literature. Mm-hmm. There's the concept of the dress scene, where a previously self-possessed or tomboyish female character suddenly emerges in this beautiful dress. We think, of course, of Jo March in Little Women.
Oh, yeah.
And when she puts on this dress, she becomes something other. She blends in. She finally emerges as what she's supposed to be. You know, she sheds mm-hmm. everything else.
And she appeals to men. Then.
She appeals to men. Mm-hmm. Or she appeals to other girls mm-hmm. in a different way too. Mm-hmm. You know, as part of that sort of society. And I traced in that paper the evolution of several gifted girls in literature. Of course, one that we might think of right now in the forefront is Hermione in the Harry Potter series.
Oh, yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, how are they presented? How bossy are they? You know, Hermione also has a dress scene, of course, just like Jo March. And there's the idea of a kind of closeting that happens with female intelligence, and also the idea that being smart makes you undesirable to men. You know, what's mm-hmm. wrong with you? Or are you a lesbian?
That has been absolutely driven into girls and women through the centuries, probably.
Uh-huh. Touch
of
Bunsen
burner.
Don't
act too smart around him. He won't want another date.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I heard that as a kid. I'm sure everybody before me did.
Mm-hmm.
And little girls are still hearing it. It is so frustrating.
Even a few years ago, the New York Times had run that article about women who had gone to Harvard hiding that they'd gone to Harvard on their dates. Because they might not get their MRS still.
It's unbelievable. Well, I do want to have you read another poem from Note That They Cannot Live Happily. This one is called Preparing the Eulogy.
Mm.
And it's a fascinating, seems like a very personal poem.
This is a personal poem. I don't always write clearly confessional poetry. I say too much confessional poetry is what got Sylvia's head in the oven.
That's right.
but this one is. And I wrote it at a time where I was very interested in being quite clear on the page. I was a little bit frustrated with people seeming to believe that what made good poetry was ambiguity or a lack of clarity. And I thought, well, what will happen if I'm very, very clear on the page? And of course, shows me, I was very clear on the page, yet still there's plenty happening underneath the surface.
Uh-huh.
So that was interesting for me. This is also told in sections, and it's also a prose poem. So this is Preparing the Eulogy. 1. I didn't prepare his eulogy. Eulogies are difficult to write. Because of this, I spoke for 2 minutes, which is just short of 86 years. 2. Let me be abundantly clear. My father is an only child. He married a woman and had an only child. They got divorced and he married my mother and they had an only child. My father's mother is dead. My father's father is dead, though as of more recently. My father now lives in Pennsylvania. People always think my parents are divorced, but they're not, not from each other. 3. In my parents' basement is a lump of beige clay and shells. They call this a paperweight. The shells are from Narragansett. In Rhode Island, a lot of places are named after Indians. My mother and I are Cherokee, not Narragansett. Cherokee are common in the Carolinas and in Texas. 4. My skin can be scraped off with my fingernails. This is only the epidermis, epi, upon or over, dermis, vascular layer. There are many things over or in us. The epiglottis, for example, is an important organ for speech, although I believe it cannot correctly be called an organ. Epitaph, on the tomb. 5. Sometimes I pretend I'm like my father. I am like him in some ways. My father is Black Irish and his papers are a mess. My papers are a mess too. 6. I have a sister who is a half-sister. She is not my sister. She has red hair and is 5 years older than I. I am 6 inches taller. I have never been to jail, but she has, the same jail where our father worked. She got extra eucerin because a guard remembered him. 7. I still forget to eat on days I drink coffee. There were days I drank a lot of coffee. This seems small now. My father still drinks a lot of coffee. I do not. I have given him mugs at Christmas for years. 8. My father wears boxers to play piano in the wide-windowed living room, and my mother blushes. We have neighbors. Pardon me, they have neighbors. The piano was my father's father's, and it skipped him to belong to me. 9. My grandfather is dead, but not my sister yet. This doesn't mean she isn't trying. My sister is not one of those women who says she doesn't do needle drugs. This should be obvious. Her heroin accompanied her to Walmart in the baby bag. 10. My mother calls after the latest OD. She repeats, blue and gurgling, as if she were an anchorwoman. I suspect she likes the sound of the words.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jamie Warburton. She's a poet and visiting assistant professor in the writing department at Ithaca College. Now, let's talk a little bit about this confessional poetry as opposed to intimate poetry, because there is a fine line. To talk to us about how you feel about how you differentiate that.
Well, I think intimacy is incredibly important to a poem, and a poem can be intimate whether you're writing from your own stories or not. And when it comes to confessional poetry, I think people can privilege the truth above the poem, or at least factual truth, a recorded history of truth. And I don't believe that's always the best thing to do. I think what serves the poem and what serves the reader's experience, what serves that sort of emotional and intellectual joining is more important than whether or not a flower was purple or red. So that's one thing. Also, I think we as poets need to get out of our own navels. And if we write too much confessional poetry, what's at stake for somebody else when they read the world? We are wide, you know, we are universes, but there are other universes outside of us as well.
I know. And when I started reading poetry as a kid, I loved Sylvia Plath and The Confessional and Anne Sexton. And
so many of us start there and love it.
We still do. People still do. But I also didn't like the academic poetry that a lot of women were writing, trying to impress their male professors, perhaps, or trying to do the dissertation, or
be taken
seriously.
Trying is what's important.
Because
there
is, you know, all the poetry between confessional and too academic are the poems that I think probably resonate with people. Now, you've written about fan fiction and fangirl communities. That's one of your areas of interest. I had never heard of this. Talk to us about it. I'm fascinated.
Well, it is fascinating. It really is. Now, fan fiction is a type of derivative fiction wherein people adapt to a universe or characters that they really love. We think Star Wars or Star Trek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, again, Harry Potter, Twilight. And they use those characters in that universe to create their own stories and their own interpretations. And fan fiction can be terrible. It can be wonderful. It has a bad rap often academically because people say, well, this isn't creative, or so-and-so is just writing herself into this, or it's just some kind of pornography. But it's and some of it certainly is.
It would be intellectual pornography, right?
or the other kind.
Ah.
But it's really interesting to see what people do with what they love. And some people do use fan fiction in the classroom when it comes to
So what are they doing? They're taking scenes mm-hmm. from some of these previously written books mm-hmm. and placing themselves in the exact same scene? I don't understand quite
that,
how it
that
works.
That approach is usually frowned upon in the fan fiction
okay.
communities. People would not like the author to be clearly inserting him or herself in
okay.
it. But for example, we might say, look at Star Wars. There are no female Jedi Knights in the original Star Wars trilogy. Mm-hmm. Someone may, and many people certainly have, write a piece of fan fiction in which there's a female Jedi Knight, or perhaps Obi-Wan Kenobi were a woman, or Princess Leia, for example, builds a lightsaber instead of Luke acquiring one. In a way, fan fiction can lead to wish fulfillment, and in a way, it can just stop the universe from ending. Now, when the final Harry Potter book came out, it was nanoseconds before people were posting stories on the internet. What was going on at Hogwarts in that year? You know, because the action never takes place really until the last battle in Hogwarts, the final Harry Potter book. So people were saying, well, what was Neville doing? And you know, where's Ginny during all of this? And it's that sort of love and curiosity for a universe that people will bring to their writing.
Oh, but I would hope that they would be able to translate that into some real creativity, though.
And that's what a lot of
because if you find out you
thinking.
Can really write,
yes.
and create a world, mm-hmm. it seems to me you could create a new one.
Yes, and pedagogically, some people do in 6th, 7th grade classrooms encourage people to write fan fiction, because it really takes some of the pressure off. It's
yeah.
almost like writing mm-hmm. a poem in form. If you say, well, I know this is going to be a sonnet, uh-huh. so I know exactly what I need to do to fill these. I don't need
yeah.
to worry about
uh-huh.
how it's going to look on the page. I'll look at the other stuff. We look at children writing. They say, well, I don't need to worry about characterizing a character. I can go with the language. I can go with the plot. You know, one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And again, yes, we might expect that they're eventually going to say, well, you know what? I'd really like a character like this. And I've learned how to characterize through reading, and now I'm going
yeah.
to move forward.
So if it gets them interested in writing, all the better. That's that part of it sounds
mm-hmm.
really great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I do want you to read a brand new work
mm-hmm.
that no one has heard or seen before. This one is called This Is the World We Wanted. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the title of this poem comes from a Louise Glück poem called Gretel in Darkness, and there's a little bit of fairy tale-ness to this poem, again, a little bit of witchery, a little bit of Gretel, and the general story of this poem is really about loving a child who's not yours biologically. Maybe you're loving the parent of that child and how that feels and how that looks in the world. This is the world we wanted. The child is flesh of your flesh alone. There is nothing to temper the dance in her blood, nothing of my sharpness or 6th grade algebra, just your gestures deep in her grand foot stamping. I become a witchy watcher, sans oven, can't molar her enough, a truffle, white. Rain has made her, and musk, and a log in the backwoods, a house less gingerbread than cobweb, cracked timber. Suspicious strangers eye my brown hands drop to tug her hair, strands tangled over Anne of Green Gables' forehead. With that brow, yes, she is the most toothsome of shade-soaked morsels, toadstool fingers, a veal fed on mother's milk and dandelion fluff. She sows weeds purposefully. She cuts her own hair, curling like yours. The arms, circumference of my wrist bones, have no bones. How could such a creature be built on a skeleton at all? How could she have come from you, love, as anything but an ununderstandable piece of sugary rennet?
Wow. There's, you know, you read that very lightly, but I found the poem kind of mysterious when I read it to myself.
I think it can be both, perhaps.
Now, you're also a singer, and you sing with a Finger Lakes Chorale,
Yes. We're in the middle of a slight renaissance. We were about to be Bella Voce. Our conductor, Doreen Allison, is joining us as a singer as well, and we're making the change to a slightly more intimate choral group, which is really exciting for us.
Wow, so it is called the Finger Lakes Women's Chorale? Wow, that's interesting. How do you think the fact that you love singing and have taught flute and play flute has affected your writing?
Well, I think that all of the arts together are really important to me. And I dance and I sing, and I was very, very into acting for a long time. And there's a great performative aspect to poetry.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great mathematical aspect to music, and of course, poetry and song were so intimately related from their very genesis that I just love it all together.
Have you ever thought about jumping the fence and becoming a composer of songs? It's an entirely different genre, obviously. But.
It is. Well, I have written the libretto for a piece that was commissioned, and some of my poetry has been adapted to musical setting before. That was really interesting for me. I really enjoyed doing that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Does that change the flavor of the poem when music is involved?
Yes. I tell my students that the difference between poetry and song lyrics, because they're often very interested in song lyrics and not very interested in poetry, is that a song lyric will be necessarily improved when you set it to music. Same thing doesn't always happen with poetry.
No, in fact,
sometimes quite the opposite. But a good poem doesn't need music.
Uh-huh.
It can become musical, but it doesn't.
I would say
need
a good poem is music.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to have an orchestra
Absolutely.
To prove that, right? Now, before we do run out of time, I do want you to read another new poem.
Mm-hmm.
This one's called The Summer Between 2 Years.
That was 2 years of grad school that I was thinking about there. Ha ha. The Summer Between 2 Years. We sat on the Yonkers balcony overlooking a neighbor's fenced yard and stone-hemmed shrine to the Virgin Mary, smoke-chaired camels, you know, grad school days before splurging on American spirits. After practice pliés, 1 and 2, hands on kitchen counter, the loose-hipped duck walk of used-to-be dancers having carried us through the hall with mugs of tea and an occasional pratfall, faux mustache, mimed elevator ride, timed to catch the other unaware, Lucy to Ethel, Laurel to Hardy, Gracie to George, and Costello to Hey Abbott. We sat on that balcony, metal-gridded base leaving SM fishnet impressions in our calves, and from an invisible nest somewhere above, near fetal birds kept falling, one every day or so, their translucent skin featherless windows to the small hot mass of just pulsing organs, blue and purple, and what had faded from red, tiny puckers in their skin suits like pores on my arms, no, neck. So slender, so nearly viable, that there was nothing to do but lift bodies one by one over the cat's curious head and scoop them, paper towel bound, into the trash.
Wow, that is quite a poem. Now, Jamie Warburton, we have almost run out of time. Is there any contact information that you would like to give? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's jamiewarburton.weebly.com.
And can you spell that?
jamiewarburton.weebly.com.
Great. Well, Jamie Warburton, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with all your future writing.
Thank
you.
It's been a real pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.